I'm Matt Wells, and this is Media Talk, live-ish from the 2009 Radio Festival in Nottingham. Coming up, the date's been set for radio's digital switchover, but is 2015 a case of too much too soon?
Well, I think there's some real challenges for the radio industry, which we need to take on to show listeners just how far digital can take them. There's plenty of work to do to convince consumers that this is the right thing to do.
You need 600 more transmitters, all manner of other jiggery-pokery to go on. It's expensive. It's probably 100 million quid.
Plus,
we support the idea of switch over. We have more concerns about switch off. If you could swap your analogue radio for a digital one, people might think, wow, there's a benefit to switch over. At the moment, we seem to be getting into this mindset where we want to force it on the public, even though the public can't really see what the benefits are.
Jeremy Hunt sets out his plans as the would-be Conservative government's culture secretary. And,
I mean, the worst possible thing to do would be to go on and say, live from Salford, live from Salford, or whatever. I don't think that's the point.
Nicky Campbell tells us which of his colleagues will be following him north. This is Media Talk from The Guardian. Now, I'm back from my holidays, sleeker, tanned, and a little bearded too. Well, it works for Steve Hewlett, who we'll talk to later. And now, we're here with the rest of the British radio industry at their annual get-together. This year, we've assembled at the Playhouse Theatre in an unusually tropical Nottingham. But while there are plenty of merry men in this podcast, there are precious few maid Marians, so apologies for the lack of female voices in this rather male-dominated part of the media landscape. Now, last month's Digital Britain report finally provided a target for digital radio switchover. But after years of the radio industry asking for a date, much of the talk here has been about the problems of meeting the 2015 deadline.
Tim Davey, Director of Audio Music at the BBC.
Stuart Taylor, Chief Executive, Guardian Media Group Radio.
You've got a switchover date now. You must be delighted.
I'm pleased because I think it gives a degree of certainty that was lacking in the industry. I mean, it's a target date, so it remains ambitious, but I really think it's helpful to have a date to which we can all aim for.
Is it a good thing, Stuart Taylor, that there is a switchover date, 2015, for digital radio?
Absolutely, it's a good thing. It now means we can focus on getting all the issues resolved that need to be resolved, whether it's with car manufacturers, with signal strength and signal build-out. It means we can get on with those things with a target date. It will galvanise people into solving the problems that need to be solved.
And what are those problems? Because there are big obstacles to switching to digital radio, aren't there, Tim Davey?
Yeah, there's some very big obstacles. I mean, at the moment, we're seeing 20% of listening on digital. So if you think about the TV switchover, we had 80% of homes with a digital television before we went to the switchover. So there's work to do.
Yeah, and TV switchover was driven by the consumers because you could fall in behind the consumers because they were driving it. This one's the other way around. You're forcing the consumers, aren't you? They're not going to be very happy about this.
Well, I think there's some real challenges for the radio industry which we need to take on to show listeners just how far digital can take them. That means increased choice, it means better functionality, and it's right to say that although we have huge satisfaction levels with those people using DAB in good coverage areas, there's plenty of work to do to convince consumers that this is the right thing to do.
There are big financial costs associated with switching to digital, aren't there, Stuart Taylor? To get everyone in an area where they can listen to digital radio, that's going to be very expensive, extremely expensive. Who's going to pay for that?
Well, there's a number of potential sources, but commercial radio has been very clear that it doesn't have the, you know, while it's continuing to pay both dual transmission for DAB and FM, it doesn't have the resources to fund this. So we've been very clear about that to government, and the government have written about this in the Digital Britain report. The BBC need to help out, and we need to get imaginative about how this is paid for over the next 10 years.
Are you ready to write a check, Tim Davey?
Well, I think the next 12 months will decide, you know, in terms of exact costs that are required.
How much do you think it's going to cost?
Well, estimates vary between £50 and £100 million to do the full switchover, but that is very loose, and I've given you a very big window there because there's a lot of detailed planning. The real detailed negotiation is the regional local layer, and where commercial viability stops and where public money will be considered.
The other big issues, Stuart, are cars, because a lot of people listen to radio in their cars. And at the moment, you can't get a decent digital signal driving around the country. How's that going to be fixed?
Well, you just said at the moment. I mean, technology is moving very, very fast. This is moving. Technology will improve. We are engaging and have engaged with the car manufacturers consistently. The two biggest, Vauxhall and Ford, are committing to DAB radios now. It has not been the highest thing on their agenda. You know, safety, emissions, compliance with the law, those things are higher up car manufacturers' agendas, understandably. But now...
Are they engaged now?
They are engaged now, and they are part of this new group that will be designed to deliver on Digital Britain.
Taxi for Mr. Davey. Just make sure you keep the receipt. Well, that's all very well and good, but what about the politicians with Gordon Brown's lot on their last legs? Will Digital Britain be taken up or ripped up by a Tory government? Here's their culture board, Jeremy Hunt.
We support the idea of switch over. We have more concerns about switch off. There are 120 million analogue radio sets, and if we were to tell consumers that after 2015 those are going to be useless and you've got to chuck them away, people would, I think, be very angry. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done before we can even think about switch off.
What sort of incentives do you think you could give to the public to be attracted to digital radio?
Well, I think the most important thing is not something the government can do, it's something the industry can do, which is to develop new services on digital platforms that actually mean there is a real consumer benefit to DAB. At the moment, the benefits are marginal. I mean, there are some benefits in terms of quality, but, you know, your batteries get used up a lot more quickly, the reception is a lot more flaky, and a lot of the things that make digital switchover attractive on TV don't apply to radio in the same way. So I think the industry needs to do a lot more to make it in consumers' interests to have that switchover. And so that's one thing. I think what the government can do, though, is work much more closely with car manufacturers. The French government has bitten the bullet on this. I think we should do a lot more.
The French government has mandated car manufacturers to put digital radios in cars. Should the British government follow suit?
Well, I have to say that I think given that the French government has done that, there may be no marginal cost to car manufacturers were the British government to say the same thing. But I think at the very least, we should be looking at incentives to encourage car manufacturers to standardise on DAB, because I think until you do that, we're not going to get the network up to the 97-98% coverage that we really need.
And what about all those old sets? You raised it in your speech here at the Radio Festival, old analogue sets that could become obsolete.
Well, exactly, and there's an environmental consideration with that as well, because I think people would be very, very concerned at the environmental cost of having to get rid of 120 million sets. So I think we've got to think about that. We've also got to think about consumer anger. I mean, these consumers are people that the radio sector needs. It's going through a very tough patch. We don't want to switch off listeners by suddenly saying that we're not going to, that we're going to force you to have a new radio. And there's, you know, there's a real danger if we do that. They might start listening to their iPods and their CD players instead.
You mentioned a possible swap scheme. How would that work? You take your old analog radio into Currys and Dixon's and get a shiny new digital one?
Yes, I think this is something I don't think it's really for the government to do, but I'm just putting it on the table as a kind of thing I think the industry might think about, because I think if you could swap your analog radio for a digital one, people might think, wow, there's a benefit to switch over. At the moment, we seem to be getting into this mindset where we want to force it on the public, even though the public can't really see what the benefits are.
Public support is important in all sorts of areas of the media, and there's been a lot of public anger over how much public figures and public in public bodies are paid. Leaving aside the whole MPs expenses thing for now, that's a story for another day. What about BBC executives? Are they paid too much?
I think they are. I mean, there are 50 executives, or nearly 50, who are paid more than the Prime Minister. Director General's paid £816,000. And these are huge sums of money, and I think it's a privilege to be Director General of the BBC, and I don't think you should automatically benchmark yourself against people of equivalent seniority in the private sector, because, you know, it is a public organisation, it is a privilege to do it, it's public service, and, you know, so I think on that basis we need to have a reality check.
And on top stars' pay, what should the BBC do about that? Publish the salaries?
Yes, I think we need to know what they're being paid, and then we can have a debate. And I think some people will say, that's what I want my licence fee to be spent on. It's only, you know, a small percentage of the licence fee. Other people might say, we shouldn't do this because we'd see them anyway on ITV.
And in terms of what the industry wants, back to the radio industry, finally, they would like to see local radio ownership rules relaxed, local media ownership rules relaxed, so that there could be more cross-media ownership at a local level. Is that something that the Conservative government would support?
Absolutely. The cross-media ownership rules at a local level are preventing the emergence of new models, and we need those new models. And at the moment, the local newspaper industry, local radio industry, local TV industry are either struggling or non-existent, and we need a healthy local media sector, and we don't have that.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on guardian.co.uk.
Jeremy Hunt. Now, someone who's never knowingly underwonked when it comes to media policy and regulation is Steve Hewlett, Media Guardian columnist and presenter of the BBC's Media Show. I asked him to clarify matters. Does all this mean that once and for all, radio is going digital?
It sounds like a bit of a stretch, to be honest. You know, the government have said, and that's probably why they haven't set a date, they've set a target, 2015, and said that by...
An aspiration.
But they've said that they won't press the button on switch off until two criteria have been met. 50% of all listening to DAB, all radio, and 90%+ coverage, so it's roughly equivalent to FM. Now, to get to that, you need 600 more transmitters, all manner of other jiggery-pokery to go on. It's expensive. It's probably 100 million quid. In that session just there, when asked, after a certain amount of fannying about, it has to be said, when asked the direct question, have you got any money in your budget now to pay for this, answer from Tim Davey, no. Speak to man from commercial radio, Phil Riley, and is the commercial sector is so flush with cash that it's prepared to, it's ready to pay? Answer, not that I'm aware of. So I don't know where, I don't know. Well, I mean, look, I can see where it comes from post-2013, but that's too late. That gets you nowhere near 2015. It comes out of the excess, so-called excess license fee. It comes out of the top slice or something. There is a slightly unnoticed line in Digital Britain which says that they will consider dipping into the digital switchover help scheme underspend in this licence fee settlement. Now, but that, if they take 100 million for this, they can't have it for broadband or local television news. So there's an awful lot of calls emerging on this BBC licence, on the licence fee underspend in this settlement.
This is, we should say, this is very interesting, isn't it? This whole top slicing business. There are, now that the principle has been conceded, it's very difficult for the BBC to make that argument. And really, I mean, you said it years ago on this podcast when they made the original concession on the targeted help scheme.
Well, that's right. I mean, they did cross the Rubicon, I'm afraid. And they can dress it up by saying, or they can present it as saying, look, it's a digital per person, so on and so on and so on. But when you think about it, giving people boxes with which to receive BBC signals, you know, have they offered, I mean, you can't receive signals without a television set. They don't give them out. You can't receive the signals without electricity supply. They don't pay my mum's electricity bill. She's over 75, well and truly, you know. So it's kind of, once you go down this line, it's very, very hard to find a sensible way back. And the problem they've now got is these other needs are popping up, which, if anything, look rather closer to the BBC's underlying purposes than some of the things they've already agreed to spend licence fee cash on. And resisting them is proving hard.
What's your overview on the radio industry then? Is it a sector flourishing and with creativity and, you know, financial good times, or is it an industry in crisis?
Well, it's an odd one. I mean, commercially, plainly, it's got its work cut out. You know, BBC Radio is in some parts of the forest, I have to say, at the front line. You know, it feels to me like it's underfunded. In some places, there aren't enough people, and you know, it is simply too tight. I won't bore you or embarrass myself with the budget of the media show. But it's not at the front line. You know, it's kind of not. I'm not saying there isn't money elsewhere, but the front line is not exactly flush with cash. On the other hand, you know, radio has a place in people's heads that is unique. And so, does it have a future? Of course, it does.
Well, policy is all well and good, but what about the content? The main headline from the Sony Radio Wars were the gongs picked up by Prison Radio Brixton, captive audiences and all that. One of those Sony winners was Tiss, a prisoner in jail for drug offences who turned his hand to radio inside. He was let out on day release to be here. Incidentally, that meant there were more people at Her Majesty's pleasure at the radio festival than there were global radio executives. Tiss was interviewed on stage by Richard Bacon.
So you say that every prisoner aspires to be better. They want to change. How did taking part in the radio programmes, how did that change you?
I came from Pentonville, and whilst I was in Pentonville, I heard about the Prison Radio Association and Electric Radio Brixton in Brixton Prison. And, you know, before I came, prior to coming to prison, I was involved in music production and stuff like that. So I thought, you know, getting some kind of a qualification in radio production would really benefit me. So, you know, coincidentally, I ended up in Brixton Prison, so I took advantage of that. And, you know, whilst doing the course, I learned a lot about, you know, radio production and the skills that you need. But also, you know, I improved my vocabulary. And I was around, you know, a lot of, you know, very influential people and, you know, people that was offering me support, and my communication skills, you know, increased, my confidence went up, you know what I mean? And
your self-esteem went up?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It went up quite high, and, you know, I found myself, a lot of other people that wasn't, you know, as fortunate as me to get on the radio station as quick as I did, you know, they showed a lot of interest as well. So, you know, I kind of took what I learned and gave them advice and told them, you know, look, how you can work towards getting on the radio station, yeah, and you can take the steps, you know, to learning some of the stuff that I'd done as well. But, you know, for me, like, my future is a lot brighter than it was when I first came to prison, and that's a lot to do with the stuff that I done at Brixton Radio. You know, I met a lot of people who, you know, before coming to prison, like the night that I got arrested, I could never have predicted, you know, meeting a lot of the people that I met whilst being in Brixton Prison. You know what I mean?
Winning an award.
And winning an award, yeah, that's like an amazing achievement. I couldn't believe it, but, you know. So I think, you know, a lot of the, the interview I done with Jonathan Akin,
yeah,
you know, he actually, you know, took to me in quite a good way, because he's kept in contact with me. He wrote me a letter whilst I was at High Point congratulating me on the awards that I've won.
Okay.
Yeah, and, you know, I met a few other people that's offered me work for when I get released. So, you know, it's really helped. It's created a lot of opportunities for me.
Brixton Prison Governor Paul McDowell remarked on stage that the prison radio scheme was a, quote, Daily Mail story waiting to happen. As it happens, I have Wednesday's edition of the Daily Mail here. Let's see. End of the heat wave, Alison Pearson, God Save the Queen and Flog the Rest. No. How this kiss sparked a trend that will disturb every parent. No, definitely nothing about prison radio in the Daily Mail. Perhaps they should have sent their media reporter up here. Now, aside from 2015, another date that's looming on the horizon is 2011. That's when Five Live will up sticks and move from West London to Salford. Nicky Campbell was the host of this year's festival, and he's confirmed that he's making the move to the Northwest. But what about his Five Live breakfast show co-host, Sheila Fogarty?
I've been speaking to Adrian Van Claveren, the controller of Five Live, about this. The geography of this is not really my issue. I'm from Liverpool. I've made twice in the almost 20-year career in the BBC. I've made decisions that have uprooted me, taken chances, left things behind in order to build things elsewhere. I have no intention of dropping, because Adrian, I mean, I hope I can say this openly, has very kindly, you know, and I'm delighted, asked me to carry on working with Nicky. What I decided to do, while everybody else around me was saying, oh, I don't want to move there, can I move there, can I do this? I decided to just, because being freelance is a slightly different thought process anyway. I mean, my feeling on it was always that I wanted to think of it in terms of the job, the time scale, because I think breakfast presenting has, well, for me, it has a time limit on it, because you can't get up at 3:45 for the rest of your life. So it was never really about geography for me. It was always about, and these are the discussions I'm having with Adrian at the moment, about the nature of the job, how it will develop. Carrying on with Nicky is a given, if you see what I mean. I'm happy to do that. The geography of Salford isn't a problem. It's, you know, it's always been about.
So you're going?
Matt,
there's a line here.
Yeah, there isn't. I'm in discussions with Adrian Van Claveren, and I'm not going to tell any of you definitively what's going on.
So that's perfectly clear then. Later, I asked Nicky why he had decided to make the move.
I love working on Five Live. I love the mix, the informality, the news, the sport, the way we do stuff, the conversational style, the context in which we do things. It's enabled me to go fantastic places, and I can't think of a better job right now. Genuinely, I think it's going to be very exciting what happens there for the BBC.
Will it make any difference in the way that Five Live sounds?
I hope it, well, only in a very subtle way. I mean, the worst possible thing to do would be to go on and say, live from Salford, live from Salford, or whatever. I think it's more subtle than that, in that it begins to take us away from being so London-centric. Paradoxically, Five Live is possibly the station that is most in touch with the whole of the UK anyway. But having said that, you know, you can't have too much of a good thing.
As the presenter of the breakfast show on a news station, you'll have found that a lot of the news has been driven by media stories in the last year, particularly stories involving the BBC. Does that put you in an awkward position as a BBC presenter?
Not really. I think you kind of put a bit of a different hat on, and you just see the story. I mean, you do the same when you report, you know, newspaper stories, or in stories about the newspaper world, or stories about The Guardian. You do, all of a sudden you become apart from it, hopefully. I think that's part of your professionalism.
Well, it's your stock question to Torrin Douglas, isn't it? A reminder.
What did the BBC have to say about this? Well, we love asking that question. And when I did, you know, Thompson did the rounds on Michael Jackson morning. That very good news story about the BBC's expenses got a bit squeezed. I was pretty robust with him, because you kind of feel it's quite good to be robust with your boss and to be allowed it. And I was speaking to Tim Davey about this the other night, the head of audio and music. He said, Tim said, Kirsty Walk, he said, she's the worst. She said, she has that kind of sneery, ooh, you're the boss's thing, you know. But he said, great, good honour. It's absolutely right. It wouldn't have it any other way. And that's the kind of almost unique thing about the BBC. Because when I was giving Thompson, I mean, Mark Thompson, I paid for my own coffee this morning, you know, and I went, oh, well done, you know, kind of five live away. So, we're getting lots of texts saying, this is what we love about the BBC.
And there's been a lot of talk about how you deliver what you do to those people out there, platforms, digital radio, the internet, listen again, iPlayer. Does that matter? Do you think about that as a radio presenter when you go into the studio in the morning about where your listeners are and how they're listening?
No. I think what you think about is what we always think about, just how I can get through the next 3 hours. You've just got to be the best that you can. I've never really thought about the other stuff, because I've gone through these crazes and obsessions. We must broadcast to, we must make sure we're targeting gingerhead people between the age of 25 and 28. And yeah, I've never thought about that. I've just thought about, if you like it, you like it, and if you don't, you don't. Enough people like it for me to have had a career, and enough people really don't like it for me to have had a career, you know, because you don't have a career in radio unless loads of people really hate you as well. So it kind of, but it's, it, hopefully it works, and you do, that's all you think about.
You're going to Salford. Your esteemed co-presenter, Sheila Fogarty, was, as we've just heard, a bit non-committal. What do you think about that?
I think that she'll go. I think she's in the middle of a delicate negotiation. It's like those footballers who say that I want to go and play for Real Madrid, and then they realise they have their contract terms renewed. Or it's when Ant and Dec say, I think Sheila's doing an Ant and Dec. We're leaving.
Is she Ant or Dec?
So that's a very good question. I think she's Dick and I'm Dom.
Nicky Campbell there, and I wonder whether some of his listeners might have him as more the Dick rather than the Dom. So that's almost it from Nottingham. I guess we should have a go at wrapping things up. Our esteemed radio reporter, Media Guardian's radio reporter, John Plunkett, is here. And John, you were, well, I saw you assiduously developing your contacts over the course of the festival. At least I think that's what you were doing, propping up the bar last night.
Yes, I have a receipt and a list of everyone I bought a drink for. So
excellent, good stuff. So what have we learned from the radio festival? Well, I have learned, John, that John Myers, the former GMG boss, is very angry with Ofcom. This is what he had to say.
They force local radio stations to, at the moment, to be in their local area, and they regulate some local things about content, because each station has a format and they must do this, that and the other. But the issue is, it's complaint-led. And so you can do what you like until somebody complains, and then Ofcom will look into it. And I'm saying, well, look, if you're going to have that system where it's only complaint-led, then just announce that's the system, and we'll all get used to that system. But I think it has to be a hybrid. I think it has to be a hybrid of complaints and Ofcom doing more listening, or keyhole listening, as I call it, to make sure that licences are doing what they said they would do. It is not unreasonable for a local radio station to broadcast material that is appreciated by the listeners of that station. What is the point of broadcasting material that nobody wants to hear? Four radio reviews in 4 years does not say the regulator is pretty good at this. You know, it's saying that they're not thinking ahead enough. And I actually think that they need to come up with a vision and a plan about where radio is going for the next 5 years. If they have another review in the next 2 years, they'll have failed.
He's not happy, is he?
He's not a happy man, no, that's right. I think it's maybe 10, 20 years of frustration all oozed out in one in one keynote speech.
What did you learn from the festival?
Well, I learned from another festival gather that it's easier to get day release from prison than it is to get day release from global radio. They were the elephant in the room. Yeah, we're expecting to hear from a couple of global radio execs, but unfortunately, due to circumstances beyond our control, word came down apparently from on high that they weren't allowed to speak. So good night, global.
Now, we're talking about good nights. We've had a few good nights here, haven't we?
We had a Well, yeah, certainly had a memorable night, the gala dinner, the prestige gala dinner.
Tell Media Talk listeners about this.
It was it's like a throwback to the 1970s, a bit like our hotel accommodation. But the food was memorable for all the wrong reasons. I had salmon, was offered the gravy boat at the end of my meal, so even if I had one today, it wouldn't have been that. It wasn't fantastically timed, and as one of the speakers said, it was a night to remember, but unfortunately for the wrong reasons. Maybe next year they'll get a better venue.
I suppose we should end on a serious note. All the talk has been of digital switchover, and well, it's very interesting. I was just saying this at the start of the podcast. The radio industry has been complaining for years about not having a date. Now they've got a date, and they're still moaning.
That's right. I think it's been a festival characterised by uncertainty. Yeah, over switchover, about who's going to pay for the DAB rollout, and now you've got it, you don't like it. So maybe next year the date would have been put back. 2020 next year.
All right. Okay. We'll see. Thanks very much, John. Well, that's it from the Radio Festival 2009. We're off to catch our train back to London, which is where we'll be next week for another special programme. This time our very first recording in front of a studio audience. Should be interesting. To have your say on anything you've heard, post a comment on our blog at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. Follow me, Matthew Wells, on Twitter. Media Talk is produced by Ben Green. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.